Last year, there was a movie out called Beautiful Boy. It's based on a true story from a book. And it's not an easy movie to watch. It's an hour and a half watching two actors bearing their souls to show us the heartaches of being father and son, doing battle with something that had intruded into that relationship. So the movie starts with the dad sitting in front of a doctor. And he says, there are moments I look at him, this kid I raised, who I thought I knew inside and out, and I wonder who he is. He's been doing all sorts of drugs, but he's addicted to crystal meth, which seems to be the worst of all of them. And I guess I'm here because I want to know all that I can about all of it. Know your enemies, right? I find it helps to, when I read Jeremiah, to remember who the enemy is, and it's not the people. At the heart of it, the story is written down so God's people remember how hard God fights for his relationship with his people, like the dad in the movie fighting for his son on drugs. And if God sounds angry, and he does, it's because he's frustrated with what his people have gotten into. As frustrated as God is with his people, his enemy is not the people. He loves his people, and that's why he's fighting so hard for them. The enemy is idolatry, which has taken his people hostage, the same way crystal meth takes that son hostage. So as we read Jeremiah, we are also not God's enemy either, because I find it impossible to hear anything it has to say if I start with the premise that God is mad at me and is yelling at me, so I would just end up being all defensive. So the harsh words in Jeremiah is not originally directed at us, so our first objective is to read it to understand what the commotion is about as the fly on the wall. And by listening to the fight like a marriage counselor, we can learn a lot about the people who are fighting and what they care about. And then once we understand that, then we can ask how Jeremiah helps us in our relationship with God, because we have a relationship with the same God. So we're eavesdropping on this heated conversation, and then we learn there's an anxious situation brewing in the world. About 300 years before Jeremiah was born, Israel split into two different kingdoms when King Solomon died because they couldn't agree who should be the next king. So 10 of the 12 tribes in the north have their own king, and they continue to call themselves Israel. The two tribes in the south have their king, and they call themselves Judah. And then 100 years before Jeremiah was born, the north kingdom, Israel, was invaded by the Assyrians, who were the original evil empire invading everybody. And by the time they are done with the place they invaded, they would have smashed everything, and they ship off all the prisoners of war to other parts of the empire. Usually they take the most capable men and boys, and this is called exile. Then they would ship in men and boys from other places. So within a generation of intermarriage, you couldn't tell what or who used to be there from looking at the people or the buildings. The people who used to be North Kingdom Israel people became the Samaritans in Jesus' time, people who have mixed blood, who had their history and cultural identity completely erased. Exile was how they got that way. Theirs was a generic name for a generic people. It's like the North people never existed. So Jeremiah was born into the Southern Kingdom, Judah, after the Northern Kingdom had been disappeared. And what happened to the Northern people raised a very anxious theological question. What happened to God? Didn't he give us this land and promise to be our God and protect us, they were asking? Because in the greater schemes of things, tiny kingdoms like Israel was never a match against superpowers if it weren't for God. So as South Kingdom people surveyed that empty parking lot where the North Kingdom used to be, they wonder what changed in their relationship with God. Were they next? And what hoops they needed to jump to get their divine protection back? So with barbarians at the gates, people got serious about going to church and went the extra mile doing churchy things because this was not a time to cheese off God. And then they would turn to the prophets for answers. Now, prophets were official spokespersons. It's a very specific job. They were not people giving an opinion on a cable news panel. The biblical prophets were persons chosen by God as official messengers. And in that job, they were let in on what God was doing in the world so they could explain it to the people. So a prophet's oracle usually had two parts. Number one, the very specific ways people had turned away from God. And number two, what they needed to do to turn back in order to avoid disciplinary actions from God. Except the message Jeremiah was given was missing the how to turn back part. They were told, because they had repeatedly ignored previous invitations to self-correction, they had crossed some point of no return. So the only thing waiting for them now was that divine interdisciplinary action. The self-kingdom's big problem, turns out, was not the barbarians, because barbarians were no match for God. Their problem was that for more than 300 years, starting with King Solomon, God's people had been messing around with idolatry on the side. It's like a married man keeping a mistress, and that's actually the way prophets talk about it. Solomon was not good with a sword like his dad, so he kept the peace in the land by marrying the daughters of neighboring kingdoms, and that's how he gathered 1,000 wives and concubines. Do you wonder how he keeps track? I often imagine Solomon strolling down a corridor in his palace. He sees a beautiful woman, and then he has to go up to her and say, "Excuse me, are we married?" Well, for every foreign woman he married who moves into the kingdom, they bring their own collection of pagan gods. For the one temple that Solomon bragged about building for God, he built many more for his wives and their gods. So what happened to the North Kingdom was exactly the thing God told Solomon would happen if he didn't get this idolatry thing under control. In 2 Chronicles 7:19, God says, "If you turn away and forsake the decrees and commands I have given you and go off to serve in other gods and worship them, then I will uproot Israel from my land which I have given them. This temple will become a heap of rubble." So in the royal record, every king, starting with Solomon, except maybe two, were said to have done evil in God's eyes. And the evil is condoning or encouraging idolatry. So by Jeremiah's time, it was a family affair. In verse 18 of our chapter, the children gather wood for the pile, the dads set light the fire, and the women and daughters make cakes for the fertility goddess Ishtar. Jeremiah was born in the time of King Manasseh. This king turned the Jewish temple into a pagan shrine. He installed idols shaped like beasts and monsters, and he brought in wizards and sorcerers and prostitutes for fertility orgies. He built shrines like this all over the countryside for the same kind of activity. And outside Jerusalem, he set up an altar to practice black magic, which involved human sacrifices. And one day, King Manasseh burned his own son on the altar to some spirit. The Bible says the place carries such horrible memories of humanity. The land was so soaked with innocent blood that they couldn't get anybody to live there. Imagine land you couldn't give away. It was eventually turned into a garbage dump with an incinerator fire that burned day and night. And Jesus pointed to that place, the stench, the memory, the fire, as his analogy of hell, a time capsule of the awful things humans are capable of. Now, ancient idolatry was never about loving an idol. These are creepy-looking things. Ancient idolatry was about stress relief. The Tower of Babel was never a tribute to Baal, the Babylonian god. It was a trap set up to snag a spirit. So a very high trap to snag a very high level spirit. Because if they could lure a spirit down to ground level, they can put a leash around its neck and make it work for them to solve their problems. Somebody says this, Baal was the rider of the clouds who brought the rain and blessed the earth. When Baal showed up, the heaven rained oil, the rivers ran with honey. Mothers gave birth to healthy children, and even the dead could be raised. And this is why people were willing to go as far as sacrificing their own children on an altar, because if that's the price to feel better, they will pay it. When people bow to mean gods with cruel and ruthless demands, they will become cruel and ruthless. This was how the Assyrians and the Babylonians became so mean. People become the monsters they kowtow to. And this was Jeremiah's unwelcome explanation to what happened to the North Kingdom people. They had sold their souls to power spirits, and God took the land away as he said he would. And then the oracle got worse. The people in the south had committed exactly the same error. So verses 6 to 9, they oppressed the foreigners, the fatherless, the widow. They shed innocent blood and followed other gods to their own harm. They steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, and jump to hoops of pagan idols. And that's all the things the Ten Commandments said not to do. And that's why God would also let the barbarians overrun the South Kingdom. And that decision was final, God says. Nothing they did now could change God's mind. And this was not what they wanted to hear, especially when they thought they had been stepping up at the temple. How dare God to not be satisfied with the extra effort and offering? Jeremiah was born about the same time as King Josiah, who was Manasseh's grandson. And Josiah became king as a boy when his dad got assassinated. During his reign, Josiah, the Assyrians were beginning to lose their iron grip on their empire. So with the Assyrians distracted fighting other wars, Josiah took advantage to reassert the Jewish identity. And he started by decluttering the temple of Assyrian gods, anything that didn't spark joy. So the story goes, he told someone to renovate the temple. And this person found a scroll of Deuteronomy in some storeroom. Deuteronomy is like a Cliff Notes version of Genesis through Numbers. And when Josiah read the scrolls, he realized for the first time what proper worship was. So he called together this national time of repentance. They tried to reestablish proper worship. And somebody came up with a slogan, probably made up posters and banners. This is God's temple. They would chant, this is God's temple. Unfortunately, in the people's minds, which had been ruined by idolatry, they thought the slogan meant, this is our Tower of Babel, our good luck charm that we cleaned up for God. And in exchange, we can now expect God to do the magic that we need to keep us safe from the barbarians. God saw through their phony reform. It was just religious kabuki theater. They were trying to manipulate God the way they manipulated idols to help with the barbarian problem. Verse 5, if you really change your ways, but look, 8, you are still trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. They were still doing those detestable pagan worship things on the side, and their outward sincerity at the temple on the weekends didn't translate into caring about the things that God cared about in their life outside the temple on the weekdays. 11, has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you? This is the verse Jesus quoted when he went to clean the temple. The worship was a lie. Eugene Peterson writes this. He says, standing in a church singing a hymn doesn't make us holy any more than standing in a barn and neighing makes us a horse. The lie was that God only cared about what they did in church and turned a blind eye to the weekday behavior. The lie was that God could be bribed with religious pretense. The lie was that God owed them something for the fancy temple they built for him so he would never let the barbarians ruin it. The lie was that God would tolerate the prostitute visits to the pagan altars and the gory things they did there, because their lives were hard and they needed the stress relief. So poor Jeremiah, talk about hard job. No wonder he didn't want it, because they kill messengers, don't they? More than once, he got death threats, and he was beaten up many times. One of the kings set fire to his scrolls. He was accused of being a traitor. Eventually, a group wanted to run away to Egypt and wanted him to run away with them. When they refused, they kidnapped him and took him by force. And eventually, Jeremiah died in Egypt as a hostage. God constantly put him in very awkward situations. Like for the first part of this chapter, he had to stand under the "This is the God's Temple" poster to expose their worship scam as they come through the door to church. And the second part of this chapter, he had to go stand in the rubbles in Shiloh, which was an important worship center in the North Kingdom before Solomon built the temple. Shiloh was also a sanctuary city, one of the Old Testament places that you run to if somebody wanted you dead. And once you're there, the priest would protect you until the facts of the dispute is sorted. So here's Jeremiah standing in the ruins of Shiloh, telling them there was no safe place to hide from the destructive tsunami that's coming their way. And God would not spare their temple like he did not spare Shiloh. So that's their story. What do we do with it? Well, option one, we can read this as someone else's story. Just leave it there. We can say, good thing I'm not them. And we never have to read Jeremiah again. Option two, we can read Jeremiah as a cautionary tale, where the moral of the story is don't be like them. Stay clear of idolatry or else. But if we read Jeremiah as a cautionary tale, he will leave us with this impending sense of doom, waiting for the guillotine to fall. If we live believing God has a last nerve, and woe to us who wear out that last nerve, then we're buying into a lie of a different sort. It's just what the devil wants us to think about God and to feel about God. And our anxiety about God's last nerve will simply add to all the other anxieties we're already feeling about life, and that will surely drive us into idolatry looking for relief. And our worship of God will shuffle towards idolatry, where we try to bribe him with good works and good behavior and good worship, expecting God to repay us with the magic we need to feel happier. I don't think God ever wants us to be on best behavior because we're afraid of him and what he might do to punish us. So maybe instead of a cautionary tale, option three is to read Jeremiah as a testimony about how God fights for his people because we need him to fight for us too, because we see ourselves in the people in Jeremiah, our own idolatrous tendencies, despite our best intentions. Modern idols don't come in the shape of Babylonian statues or towers. There's a scene in that movie where the son is speaking in a support group for addicts. And he says, "One day I tried methamphetamines and I thought, this is what I've been missing. I felt complete and I've been chasing that high ever since. It's never enough. One day I woke up in the hospital and someone asked me, 'What's your problem?' And I said, 'I'm an alcoholic and an addict.' And he said, 'No, that's how you've been treating your problem.' I Googled rehab places and they all say this: people take drugs because they want to change something about their lives. Maybe it's loneliness, maybe it's feeling empty or rejected or pressured. The drugs started as a solution, but eventually they become the problem." I think idolatry is a lot like addiction. It starts with us wanting to fix our anxious feelings. I'm pretty sure the first idol worshiper was trying to fix something, maybe his worries over his crops, or a harsh winter, or some disease killing his village. On Chinese New Year's Eve, some of my relatives rushed off from dinner to go to a shrine in Richmond to light incense. They wanted to make sure that they secure the quota of good luck for this next year, so they'd feel better about whatever anxiety they may have had about what the new year would bring. I saw this guy on Facebook with his car on fire. He apparently bought a new BMW, and he felt the need to bless his car. Maybe he was worried that he used up too much of his good luck on this extravagant purchase, so he lit incense sticks inside the car and ended up setting his brand new car on fire. So there's this picture of a dark char lump shaped like a car. This is how idolatry creates more anxiety and problems than it fixes. When God first came to Abraham and offered to be his God, he was saving Abraham from this vicious cycle. Having God as our God, let's call that proper worship. It's about learning to see ourselves and our lives through God's eyes. And we let God's point of view and his core values shape us, including our anxieties. Proper worship changes us. This is how. Idolatry, on the other hand, keeps us seeing ourselves and ourselves and our lives and even God entirely through the lens of our anxieties. It's a vicious cycle, because the more we fixate on our problems, the more anxious we get. And the more consumed we are by anxiety, and the more we become dissatisfied with God is or isn't doing to make us feel better. And so we instinctively look elsewhere for more potent stress relief. And we will do anything at some point, even if it's bad for us, or bad for the people around us, or bad for our relationship with God. We will pay whatever price the fear dragon wants for a moment of peace. And then the whole thing starts again. It's like drug addiction. Idolatry dehumanizes us. It takes over our lives and makes us chase anxiety relief like an addict chases a high. And no wonder there's then no room to care about the things God cared about. We're too busy feeding our fear dragon. And the persistent desperation turns us into the cold, heartless things we worship, because we become the dragon we feed. I have a friend whose dad has a gambling addiction, and his wife separated from him in Taiwan when she had to protect the family from loan sharks that would show up at the house with iron pipes for breaking kneecaps. So I was sitting next to her in the car one day when he called from Taiwan. He was trying to get at some bank account that his wife had. And he wanted my friend to call the bank to impersonate the mom so the bank would release the funds. And I watched her next to me being dismantled emotionally before my eyes. He berated and scolded and shamed her, whatever it took to get his way. He was looking at my friend through his addiction eyes, not as a daughter to love and protect, but as some sort of ATM to hack. There's nothing lovely about idolatry, because it does this to us. What's addictive are those moments of temporary relief, the gory sacrifices, the sex fertility rituals, and Baal worship. It felt like Vegas compared to what happened at the temple. Jewish temple worship was not Cirque du Soleil. Instead, they lamented. They examined their lives, they came clean about their failings, they made repairs or mistakes, and read from scrolls that reminded them what God cared about. Proper worship doesn't make any promises about making us feel better afterwards, because proper worship doesn't revolve around our happiness. Idol worship, on the other hand, is titillating, because it makes our needs and appetites center stage. There's this young Canadian singer who became huge through YouTube. I won't say his name. He was one of Time Magazine 2018 most influential persons, and he's hardly like 20. He was on TV recently talking about the high he gets performing in front of 20,000 adoring fans, how addictive that is. Now, if I have tiny taste of what he's talking about on stage, being the center of attention and admiration and adoration, he fills in their longing for an idol, and in turn, they feed his human need for love and affirmation. And many talented people have been eaten up by this vicious cycle. I hope it doesn't happen to him. And this is the kind of high we get from idolatry. And it's the tricky thing about modeling church worship after the big venue concert experience, which manufactures a spiritual high until we crash, and we need to chase down those feelings again. So God asks this perplexing question in Jeremiah 8, 4 to 5. When people fall down, do they not get up? He's asking, isn't getting up what you do when you fall down? We fall down because there's gravity. Under the right circumstances, like a banana peel, we fall. It happens. The problem would be if we fall down and we can't get up. God doesn't sound very surprised that we turn away from him for more attractive pain relief. That he gets. But the thing that puzzles him is why we don't turn back to him when those solutions turn out to be duds and all the things in our lives go from bad to worse. The Hebrew word for turn is suf. It looks like English, S-H-U-V. Let's say that together, suf. It's a cute word. Sounds like something you do with your hips when you're dancing. So here's Jeremiah 8. When people fall down, don't they get up? When someone suf away, do they not suf back? Why then have these people, my people, sufed away? Why does Jerusalem keep sufing away? Why? Because it's what happens. When we look at ourselves and the world and even God entirely through our anxious feelings and appetites, when we are mastered by them, we will be desperate for relief and we'll be willing to throw everything good under the bus to get it. If we can admit to our own idolatrous tendencies and that we too have a wandering spiritual eye, then what Jeremiah wants us to know is that we can always count on God to fight for us to win us back. I wish I can say that because of Jesus, God never does this sort of heavy-handed correcting anymore. I so wish for that to be true, but I just don't know. And who am I to say what God can or cannot do? But what I do know for sure is that God still cares about the same thing, loving the foreigners, the widows and orphans, and anyone who needs help. And if we really love God as our Heavenly Father, we have to grapple with how we're engaging with the things God cares about. And if we are allowing God's core values and perspective shape the whole of us, the way we love and the way we carry our anxieties and appetites. We live in fearful times, somebody says in something I read last week about Lent. This means we have a lot of reasons to be looking around for quick fixes to our anxieties and our fears. It's what we do. The good news out of this angry story is that God never throws us away, even for turning to idols. As exasperating as we are to him, God is always inviting and inspiring us to suf in his direction. And when we get too far gone and can't suf back to God in the end, God will do the sufing towards us. This is the gospel. John says Jesus came to us when we got so lost that we couldn't find our way back to God. God came to us to find us, to show us the way back. God sufs to us when we become incapable of sufing back to him because God never gives up on us. He's always fighting for us. The room where I work, I sit against the wall in front of computers, and next to me is a window, and behind me is a table piled high with all kinds of things that I mean to read, but haven't gotten around to. And then behind that is a mountain of boxes and things I bought online that I haven't opened. So one day, I started reading Marie Kondo, you know, the Japanese woman teaching people how to declutter. I saw her on TV talking about clutter, and I heard something that sounded like a spirituality on clutter, so I thought I would buy her book to read. Well, I read like two chapters, and then I put the book down and decided I should declutter the stuff behind me. It took like half a day, almost throughout my back, and after it was done, I was dead tired, I plopped myself back in my chair with the clean room behind me. Guess what I felt? Sadness. It surprised me. I realized in that moment there was some idolatry going on in my life. Whatever that sadness was, instead of figuring out and asking God to help me carry it, I had buried it under piles of online shopping. And I'm starting to suspect that same sadness may be in my relationship with food and social media. I don't think we can ever self-help our way out of idolatry. Only God can save us from idolatrous ways and teach us to see the world and ourselves and our anxieties through his eyes. The only thing we can try to do is to be proactive in surfing to God and learn to be responsive to the messengers God sends, so when we find ourselves off course, we're quick to surf back. That's what King David was famous for. One of the ones who didn't do evil in God's eyes, despite all of his failings as a person. So Lent is the time of year when we practice surfing to God. It started on the 6th and ends on April 18 as the time to prepare for Easter. Traditionally, Lent involves fasting. It's kind of like decluttering ourselves of food as a way to expose anxieties and yearning. I'm fasting for Lent for the first time ever, and it's nothing that crazy. I just cut my portion of dinner so that I'm hungry by the time I go to bed and when I get up in the morning. And every time I feel hungry, it's like a bell. Every time I feel hungry, I surf my attention to God for a moment. I say something if I have something to say, and I look at the suffering around me to see if there's something I get to do. It's helping me to feel more aware of God, and I'm hoping it's a way to let God shape my anxieties and longings, rather than me being mastered by them. So there's still time to get in on this if you feel like you want to intentionally surf to God and see the ways God surfs to you by what he shows you. And then at the end of Lent, you get to write the ending to the sermon. So I thought we could end with a moment of surfing. So let me ask you to bow. And I invite you to feel the empty in your stomach. You're probably hungry by now. It's noon. So let that mild, unpleasant sensation soothe you to God. Give him your attention for a moment. Say what you want to him. And then think about the suffering in the world. Let God show you something you get to do about it. Father, forgive us when we surf away from you. Help us to surf back in your direction so you can shape our longings and anxieties so we're not mastered by them. Save us. In Jesus' name, amen.